Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello and welcome. My name is Alice DeBoos. I'm the managing partner of Kingston Reid.
And my name is Lucy Shanahan, and I am also a partner with Kingston Reid.
Welcome to the third podcast in our series about managing investigations, specifically within New South Wales Health. In the first two podcasts, we discussed preparing for the investigation and actually doing the investigation. This third podcast is all about making the findings, the role of the decision maker, and the steps that need to happen once a decision has been made. Obviously, this is one of the most important steps in the investigations process. You don't want to ruin all of the great work that you've done in the investigation so far. The findings have got to be supported by evidence, and that's got to be clearly set out in your investigation report. Someone picking up that report, like a decision maker, has to read the report and understand why you've made the findings that you have. This is such an important task, Lucy. It's got to be overwhelming for an investigator, having made a decision about whether or not some conduct that is actually alleged has actually occurred.
You're right, Alice. It is pretty overwhelming. And I think it's overwhelming because people think that they have to act in the position of a judge because, you know, in our society, they're the people who really make decisions. But it's important that an investigator remember that they're not a judge. They're not in court. They haven't taken evidence from witnesses who have given an oath to tell the truth. And then they're not doing the job of a judge. All they can do as part of the investigation process is determine whether on the basis of the information that they have access to, it's more likely or more probable than not that the alleged conduct occurred. And it's really important to understand that process. And that is called making a decision on the balance of probabilities.
That's a civil standard of proof, isn't it? It's not like beyond reasonable doubt that you will see on the telly in criminal matters.
Oh yeah, no, it's not beyond reasonable doubt. And there's no way that you could actually determine something beyond reasonable doubt because the people that you've spoken to, as I said, they're just witnesses sitting in a room. They're not in a court where they've, you know, made an oath to tell the truth. Obviously you want them to tell the truth, but there's not the same pressure as they're in a court. One thing that it's really important that an investigator understand though is that the more serious the alleged conduct that they have investigated, then the higher the bar is that the investigator has to get over to satisfy themselves. So they have to be more certain than not the more serious the allegation is. And that's called the Brigginshaw principle.
Ah, the old Brigginshaw principle. So if the conduct is so serious that, for example, it would result in the termination of an employee's employment, that's where the Brigginshaw principle comes into it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And the investigator has to be really very satisfied that the alleged conduct occurred.
As opposed to a little bit
just
satisfied.
Just a little bit satisfied.
For a less serious allegation, then you don't apply the Brigginshaw principle, but you still apply that test of whether it's more probable than not that the conduct occurred.
That's exactly right. They have to still be satisfied on the basis of the information that they've got that it's more probable than not that the alleged conduct occurred.
So what types of findings can be made by an investigator? I often find that investigators get a bit muddled here.
Yeah, and if you're an investigator, the first thing you really need to do is make sure that you've read the relevant section of your policy because it actually details the three potential findings that can be made by an investigator. So it's important that you make a finding that's in compliance with the policy because if you don't, then that will expose the investigation to criticism and potential overturning. So the first potential finding that can be made is that the allegation is substantiated or partially substantiated.
Right, and that means that on an assessment of the evidence in front of you, that you as an investigator is satisfied that the alleged conduct occurred or occurred in part.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it might be, for example, that an allegation is that someone was bullied and that the bullying occurred by a person coming into an office, swearing at the person in the office and then slamming the door. And the investigator might find that the person came into the office, did say something to a person but didn't swear but did slam the door. So you would find that the door slamming occurred but not necessarily the swearing occurred. So that's where an allegation is substantiated in part.
What's the next one?
So another finding that can be made under the policy is that an allegation is not substantiated.
And I guess naturally that means that there is no evidence that the alleged conduct occurred, or that there is evidence that the alleged conduct did not occur. So it's a positive finding, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's right. And it's when you can make those findings, it's really nice, because often these findings are difficult to make because the evidence is so inconclusive.
Mm. And what about the last one?
The last one is that conduct cannot be substantiated due to insufficient or inconclusive evidence.
And this one is really where I find that people trip up a bit. It's important that we're making this decision that the investigator is satisfied that they don't have enough evidence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the investigator needs to be prepared to actually ask themselves that question. You know, is there enough evidence here to support the finding I would like to make? And if there isn't the evidence available to justify the finding, or, you know, there's no basis to make that finding, then you might need to go back and gather more information, ask more questions, re-interview people.
Mm. An example of this could be where what is often referred to as a he said, she said situation with no witnesses and no other evidence to suggest a pattern of behaviour which would make you think that it was more probable than not that you would like to prefer the evidence of one witness over another. Is that
That's right, absolutely. It's interesting because I've seen situations where an investigator has made a finding that they are not able to actually reach a conclusion about a particular allegation. But in their analysis, they've made comments like, you know, from my experience or based upon the conduct of the interviewee in the interview, I would like to find and would in the app, but I cannot because of the absence of evidence. So it's often possible for an investigator to actually put some analysis that might suggest what finding would be made if the evidence was available.
Sure. That brings us to the investigation report. It's got a really important role, doesn't it? It sets out the findings and the facts supporting the findings. The report really needs to make clear the basis on which each finding is made with reference to the specific evidence. And a well set out report should do that, shouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly right. And as you said at the outset, Alice, the report is so important because someone, like the decision maker, has to be able to pick up the investigation report and understand why certain conclusions have been reached. So it can't contain irrelevant information. And, you know, if new allegations arise during the investigation, then the investigator really needs to assess whether they actually form part of the investigation, the matter being investigated, or a new investigation actually has to be commenced about them.
Yeah, because if they're unrelated to the subject matter, then they probably need to be investigated separately, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's really important that an investigation report also include any material which, you know, might set out any mitigating factors or might explain how the employee, the subject of the investigation, is not guilty of the alleged misconduct. So, and then often it can be hard to define that line where material is relevant in respect to those mitigating factors rather than completely irrelevant. And that can be quite a difficult decision for an investigator to make.
Yeah, because some of these investigations can be quite nuanced, can't they?
They can.
So as an investigator, you really need to be including all information that was relevant to you undertaking your task.
Yes.
Such as undue delay or the way that the witnesses behaved in the interviews.
Absolutely.
That all needs to go in there because it assists the decision maker, doesn't it?
It sure does.
In understanding the context in which you've reached your conclusions.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. It's this final report that goes to the decision maker, and then of course their role is to either accept or reject the findings of the investigator. They don't have to accept the investigator's findings and can accept some and not others, can't they?
They can, and also under the policy, the decision maker can also ask the investigator questions or ask the investigator to make further inquiries. So it's also, you know, the investigator needs to be prepared for that. It might not happen, but absolutely it might. And the decision maker also makes decisions about what action is going to be taken by the LHD in response to the findings too.
Yeah, and I've certainly been in cases where the decision maker has just accepted the findings in the investigation without applying any kind of review or judgment to that, and that has come undone because ultimately it's the decision of the decision maker that will be interrogated in any court, not necessarily the findings of the investigator.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the investigator might be asked about the process that they undertook or the evidence they relied upon, but yes, the decision maker is ultimately responsible, so needs to really understand the basis on which they've accepted the outcomes.
Yeah. And that's why the decision maker needs to be really, really carefully selected. Now, the policy or the award may set out clearly who the investigator has to be,
yep.
But where there is some discretion, that should also be exercised carefully to make sure the decision maker shouldn't be a person who has any conflict of interest at all involving the complainant or the complaint, and has to be objective and impartial.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's really important too that the decision maker is identified at the outset of the investigation, because the decision maker can't be involved in the investigation. So to clarify who is going to be the decision maker will mean that, you know, that person can't inadvertently become involved in the investigation throughout the process.
And if adverse findings have been made in the report and the decision maker supports those adverse findings, then under the policy, before a decision is made about the LHD's response or the action that will be taken, the staff member needs to actually be advised, don't they, and given the opportunity to provide additional information or raise concerns about the investigation process. That's not something that happens ordinarily in perhaps private sector investigations, but is a really clear step that's under the policy that needs to be undertaken in the public sector.
That's exactly right. And if you don't do it, you're exposing yourself to criticism, to a claim by the union that the investigation is inappropriate or unfair or shouldn't be relied upon. Because what this is essentially doing is giving the employee the opportunity to show cause in response to the findings. So the employee is entitled to have access to sufficient information to enable the employee to understand the alleged conduct. And really, that should have happened during the investigation process.
Yeah. But it's another bite at the cherry.
It is.
So if you've done a good investigation, this separate opportunity, if you like, from the decision maker should be readily responded to.
Yes, that's correct.
In doing so, the policy states that the employee needs to be given a reasonable time in which to respond. And the policy actually suggests 2 weeks. Personal view is I'm not sure why anyone needs 2 weeks. It seems like a ridiculously long period of time, but it's in the policy, so you really shouldn't be insisting on a time period that's shorter than what's recommended unless there is really exceptional circumstances for that.
Yeah.
And if those circumstances exist, then make sure in the notification to the employee that you explain why you're moving away from the recommended time frame in the policy.
The other interesting thing that we don't often see in, I guess, private sector investigations is that the policy also gives the staff member the right to make submissions about proposed disciplinary action. Now, you can seek that response at the same time that you ask the employee for their response to the adverse findings. But if you do and the findings need to be reviewed, then you would need to go through that process again, and you might need to give the employee a further chance to respond to any disciplinary action. So just think about how you might time those two opportunities that the employee gets to give responses to aspects of the investigation.
And any decision made by the decision maker has got to be proportionate to the conduct, doesn't it?
Yes, and what you think is proportionate might be different to what I think is proportionate, so it can be quite difficult to assess.
Yeah, but I guess that the best advice is that a variety of factors need to be considered, and these are also helpfully set out in a policy and include the protection of patients, clients and children for whom the organisation is responsible for, the health, well-being and safety of staff, the seriousness of the misconduct, any penalties that might be prescribed by legislation in relation to the conduct, length of service and previous work history, and any mitigating factors. So really the best process would be one where the decision maker actually records against all of those factors what he or she considered in relation to this particular case, because that would be an absolutely perfect piece of evidence in any proceedings that came out of a challenge.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea. The policy also sets out a various options that are available to the decision maker. They can take no further action, which, you know, they need to be able to make sure that they can justify it if they're challenged in the future about why no action was taken.
On the basis of those factors that we just spoke about.
That's right. Yeah. Remedial management action can be taken. So that could be done where a finding has been made about misconduct, but it's not considered to warrant disciplinary action, or where conduct can be addressed in a different way. So, you know, through, I don't know, some sort of performance management or some sort of training or coaching.
Maybe mediation.
Mediation.
Something like that.
That's right. And then the final option that's available is disciplinary action, and that could include a formal warning or even up to termination of employment.
But if you were going to issue a formal warning, that would need to really clearly state what the issue is, what was expected, the LHD's consideration against the factors in the policy, as well as the consequences for failing to reach the standard required in the future. So what's going to happen if this happens again needs to be set out in that letter.
And don't forget, of course, that the employee must be given the opportunity to respond to the proposed disciplinary action, and the decision maker has to consider that response.
Yeah. And again, because we're lawyers and we love the creation of evidence, the decision maker's consideration of that response has got to be recorded somewhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Reference it in the warning letter.
Yep.
Reference it somewhere in a file note. But if there's no evidence that the decision maker considered it at all, then we have to rely on his or her oral evidence. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, that's not the best evidence that could be available.
No. And it leaves the decision maker open to, you know, criticism and challenge.
Yep. Finally, we're almost at the end of the policy. A risk assessment has to be completed regardless of the outcome of the investigation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because as you and I both know, Alice, from our own experience, the end of an investigation process does not leave an employer with a really clear and happy workplace. There are always issues to address following the end of an investigation process. And so the risk assessment allows the employer to identify any issues that require ongoing management. And that might be between, you know, two employees who have been participants in the investigation, or from the complainant and the respondent, and work out how they're actually going to manage those ongoing issues.
One final reminder before we go. Once the investigation is finished and all persons involved have got to be informed of the outcome insofar as it relates to them, you've got to have regard to your confidentiality obligations, but everyone who is involved in the investigation should receive some form of communication telling them an outcome that is relevant for them, and telling them that the investigation is over and thanking them for their participation. I mean, for a witness, you don't need to tell them any outcome other than thank you for cooperation, the investigation is now complete. For the complainant, that will be a different communication again, but you don't necessarily have to tell the complainant about the outcome in relation to any disciplinary action against the alleged perpetrator or respondent involved. So these communications will be different for each participant, but you need to make sure that you've tied off the loop and everyone has been informed that the investigation is complete.
Yeah, the other important thing too is to consider if any support is required for those people who were involved in the investigation or involved in the process and impacted. So participating in an investigation is inherently stressful. It's stressful for both the complainant and the respondent, but it can also be quite stressful for witnesses too. So, you know, as part of your risk assessment process, just considering whether or not support is required on an ongoing basis is something you should really do.
Okay, and that's a wrap on the investigation and on this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and we shall certainly be doing more in the future.